From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The kind of energy that human beings use to power their lives is shifting around the globe. Renewable sources of energy are on the rise. The International Energy Agency expects renewable electricity generation to increase by more than a third over the next 4 years. That's according to CNBC. In the last 12 years, Charlotte-based Duke Energy has invested about $6 billion in wind and solar energy, says company spokesman Randy Wheelis. He identifies North Carolina as second in the nation for solar energy. North Carolina's incentives for solar energy producers expired in 2015. Today, we'll find out whether and how that has impacted the solar market in the state and what other energy technologies are emerging here. Last summer, the North Carolina General Assembly passed House Bill 589, an act to reform the state's energy policy and its approach to integration of renewable electricity generation. Here to take us on a guided tour of emerging alternative energy technology, some of the built-in challenges, and how this relatively new state law will affect the alternative energy market are two energy experts. Steve Calland is the executive director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State University. Steve Calland, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you for having me.
Roger Hsu is a senior lecturer in the Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences and Environmental Science at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He worked for Shell Oil for 20 years in the Gulf Coast and regularly gives presentations on wind energy around the Cape Fear region. Roger Hsu, welcome back to the program.
Thank you much for having me.
And we're inviting your questions on this Wednesday. What do you want to understand about the growth of alternative energies? Are there energy generation methods you support or think should be abandoned? Give us a call on this Wednesday and tell us about it at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Steve Callen, what would you say the biggest assist from this new law, descriptively titled An Act to Reform the State's Approach to Integration of Renewable Electricity Generation Through Amendment of Laws Related to Energy Policy and to Enact the Distributed Resources Act? How will this help the alternative energy market grow? What does it do?
Well, it does a lot of things. It was a bill that had pieces for different parts of the solar industry and a couple of other things in it as well. I think that the biggest help was that it gives some certainty to the utility scale, the larger scale solar developers in the state as to what the policy framework is going to be in North Carolina. There had been I wouldn't say a lull, but there had been a lot of uncertainty floating around because of conflict that was starting to emerge around solar development. And this bill really helps to kind of flesh out what that framework looks like going forward, and it brought some level of peace between the solar development community and the electric utility community that's going to allow us to continue to grow. North Carolina is already the second largest state in terms of installed capacity for solar.
And what does that mean, installed capacity?
So it's in terms of the installed solar in the state that supplies electricity to the grid. It is important to note that solar is a technology that runs at a lower capacity factor than some of the traditional energy resources. So solar runs at about a 20% capacity factor, whereas a nuclear power plant might run at a 95% capacity factor. So it takes more solar to equal that nuclear power plant. But that said, we have one of the largest installed bases of solar in the country, and this legislation basically says we're going to double that over the next 4.5 years or so.
Now, help us understand the solar picture here. It was a few years ago that a lot of solar producers were coming into the state to set up farms, solar panels, industrial fields with these panels to produce solar energy. That's dropped off, but how many other solar producers are in the state? How does that work, and how does that feed into the existing grid?
Well, there are a number of developers that are active in the state, and we've actually been blessed in some sense that we've grown a lot of our development community from scratch here in North Carolina. In fact, a lot of the companies that are now major players in North Carolina have spread their wings and are now becoming major players nationally in the solar development world. So much like the general trend of solar creating a lot of jobs nationally, we've benefited from this here in North Carolina in terms of job creation. But what we're starting to see now is a shift in the development in the state. In the early days, a lot of the development was driven by state incentives combined with federal incentives and by very low-cost land prices in the eastern part of the state, particularly between I-95 and here. And we saw most of that development occur in that region of the state. This new legislation that's passed last summer will have the effect of starting to shift some of that development attention to the western part of the state over time in order to try and achieve some balance in where the solar is located in the state for the electric utility grid that Duke Energy manages.
Is it fair to say that solar is the most promising and the largest emerging alternative energy technology in the state, Roger Hsu?
I think solar is right now the most important. Wind could actually, you know, rival that quite easily with incentives that go particularly for the offshore world, which obviously solar is not possible in. Right now, though, solar with its, you know, greater than 3 gigawatts of, you know, installed capacity, with its multiple hundreds of, you know, manufacturing jobs and 7,000 plus people that are working in the solar field, it really is a valuable thing for North Carolina. And it's well worth saying that one of the really important things that led us to so much solar was the renewable energy mandate that was passed in 2007, which highlighted that we would get enough renewable energy, 12.5% by 2021. Right now in 2018, I think it's at the 10% is the requirement for 2018. And of course, part of that is solar. Poultry and swine waste can be another part as well as wind, but we've been kind of stopped on the wind side for two things. One is with the moratorium, which was part of HB 589, which put a moratorium through this year, through December of this year, to have no wind. But
help us understand, why was a moratorium on wind farm permits enacted? What was important about that for legislators?
One of the things that happened in this state was several people, that was mentioned before, is people have an issue sometimes with renewable energy. One of those was looking at wind energy and its possible impacts with the military. And in the eastern part of the state, where there was some sightline and radar issues that were brought up by some of the politicians, which, by the way, the Defense Department said there was no issue. They reduced the number at the Amazon wind farm from 150 turbines to 104, and they were just fine with that. Some of the folks, though, said that it was incidental to the Department of Defense as well as to issues associated with, you know, health, sight line, people worried about, you know, with storms, tornadoes actually ripping things up. But a lot of those are just, you know, non-issues, really. Most solar farms and turbines are, you know, scheduled at Category 3 to 4 hurricanes. There's only been, you know, 0.1% of solar panels, in fact, over the last 10 years that have been damaged. So that was really a non-issue, too. One last statement, though, on those with the wind. Some people, even the year before, not last year, but in 2016, really wanted to even move solar panels and turbines away from property lines, all the way for a mile and a half away from a property line. And it bears notice that if you look at other things that are sited next to property lines, like, you know, waste management, landfill areas, you're looking at 200-foot, you know, offset or setback from the property line. And for CAFOs, animal operations, you know, the distance is, you know, I think 200 to 500 feet. So anyway, there's really a non-issue with those, you know, complaints that were being made.
the moratorium on wind energy permits. And was that addressing, by the way, on and offshore, or is this strictly onshore?
This is an onshore operation. The offshore is a very different world when you're looking at it. The problem with the offshore world is really two things. It takes forever, you know, to actually site these. Last year, when Avangrid got the permit for $9 million from BOEM to put in the offshore wind farm, you know, that's going to be another probably 5 years or so before you ever get wind offshore. It's a very long process. And plus the view shed, there's a restriction there that it had to be 33 nautical miles offshore because you didn't want to be able to see the wind farms from the Body Island Lighthouse. So we can talk about the offshore, but that's kind of the difference that we're looking at.
And we're going to get more into that. It's an exploration today of emerging energy technologies, specifically in North Carolina, and how public policy is impacting the growth of renewables in the state. We have a question from Carl. He says, I'm wondering the best way to incorporate solar into keeping my butt warm in my house. I have no solar now, so cost would be something to keep in mind. And this is a great question. I'm sure a lot of people are wondering the same thing. Rooftop solar for private residences. What is the range of cost, Steve Calland?
Well, the range of cost is a hard one to pin down because there are so many variables in the equation that determines how big or how small you go. And then on the flip side, you're comparing it to a cost that historically, traditional electricity has been very inexpensive in North Carolina.
And I'm going to let you continue on that thought when we come back from this break. You're listening to Coastline on 91.3 and 98.9 FM. We're exploring alternative energy technologies in North Carolina, which ones are growing, what some of the challenges are for further growth. Steve Calland of North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center out of NC State is with us, along with Roger Hsu of UNCW's Department of Earth and Ocean Sciences and Environmental Science. If you'd like to ask your own question on this Wednesday, you can call us at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Today, it's an exploration of renewable energy technology in North Carolina, how market mechanisms affect the growth, which technologies are showing promise, where the challenges are. Roger Hsu is a senior lecturer in UNCW's Earth and Ocean Sciences and Environmental Science departments. Steve Calland is executive director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State, and they're taking your questions on this Wednesday. Have you installed a solar roof? Are you thinking about it? What are other ways that you would like to incorporate renewable energy into your life? Call us and tell us about it at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. Just before we went to break, Steve Callen, you were explaining what the range of cost is. Carl had asked about heating his home with a solar rooftop system. What is the range of cost there?
I wish it was a simple answer. You know, so with solar, there's a lot of different things that you can do. And probably the first thing is to touch briefly on technology. When most people talk about solar today, they're talking about photovoltaics, which is an electric technology. But for heating your home, you have other options as well. There is something called solar thermal technology, which was very popular in the 1970s and 80s and is still a very good technology. We just don't see it as commonly here, but there are contractors out there that do work in that space. And that technology heats hot water. That heat, you know, it can also be used to heat air in a home, and it can be used to fairly efficiently drive down your heating bill. Particularly if you're not already using natural gas for heating, which is pretty hard economically for solar to compete with.
Why is that a technology, the solar thermal technology, that we've seen drop off?
There's a lot of reasons that it happened, but I think the problem was that we did some bad things on the policy side that were designed to help the technology in the 70s. We over-incentivized it, and we didn't have a lot of controls on what, you know, qualified for those incentives. And so there was some bad product that got installed. And then the incentives went away in the 80s when the energy crisis was over, and then all of the people that had gotten into the business left the business, and so then you couldn't find anybody to fix a bad system. And that 1-2 punch really did a lot of damage nationally to the solar thermal industry. It's still popular in Florida and in some of the southwestern states, and if you go to Mexico or to China or to Israel or basically any Mediterranean country, a lot of African countries, you'll see solar thermal everywhere. But it's just not that common here because, for the most part, electricity is more flexible than hot water, and so people have tended to focus on the electric technology. Now, that said, if you're looking to put electric in your house to offset your electric bill, again, it depends on what you're trying to do. Do you want backup power in your house if a storm knocks out the power and you want to have batteries with that? You might have a smaller system that would, you know, keep the refrigerator going for a certain amount of time after the storm rolls through. If you wanted to actually, you know, have an ongoing system that's trying to offset part of your monthly use, that's a slightly larger system. If you wanted to go completely off-grid, that's a much larger system, probably also involves batteries. The size of your family, the amount of energy you use, and please, 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 if you're going to do solar on your home, please find every piece of energy efficiency you can find first and do that first, because those are much cheaper technologies that reduce the size of what you need in the solar electric. So all of that said, there are contractors out there that might get mad at me for trying to take a wild guess at this, but I've seen systems for residential homes that are in the $7,000 range, and I've seen the systems for residential homes that are in the $25,000 range. Fortunately, depending on what you're trying to do, fortunately there are still some incentives out there. There's a federal 30% tax credit that would be applicable to both technologies.
And is that's just an upfront? How does that work?
It's a tax credit, so it's what I guess we would call above the line.
Okay.
It's not a deduction, it's a credit. And there are a lot of other incentives out there, and one of the things that's come about because of the same legislation we were talking about earlier is a new utility rebate program that is not quite available yet but is getting ready to roll out. And Duke Energy is sponsoring that program, and so there's information on Duke Energy's website. There's also a website that we maintain called the DESIRE database. It's the database of state incentives for renewables and efficiency. I'm going to give the web address slowly because it can get a little sketchy on the web if you type the word DESIRE in and don't get it exactly right.
And we'll post this on our website as well,
that'd
so it's
great.
Easy to find.
But the website is DSIREUSA.org. And that website will give you a U.S. map. You can click on North Carolina, and it will list over 90 different types of incentives that are available for different renewable technologies, some at the federal, some at state, some at the local level, some at the individual utility level here in North Carolina.
And you mentioned before you actually install anything, finding all of the possible energy efficiencies that you can find in your house. Roger Shue, can you just give us some examples of common efficiencies that people could probably find?
Yeah, there's a lot of them. In fact, one of the things I do is I put together something that can show people that they can reduce their energy consumption by 10%, and they really won't even feel the difference. And several of those are, things like obviously weather stripping for your house, insulation for your house. And one of the really big ones, though, is Energy Star programs that are really, really big. Unfortunately, the current administration has, proposed doing away with Energy Star, or at least putting it into private hands. I think it's proper within EPA, Department of Energy, for having the Energy Star program. Matter of fact, last year, it was a $61 million investment, and you get several hundred billion dollars back, off of this thing for Energy Star benefits. So when you look at this, one of the things that you think about is, what can we do in our home? So one of the things that you can do is just change your thermostat by 1 degree, either lower it in the wintertime or raise it in the summertime, and that's 3-4% energy savings right there. Of course, another big one is vampire energy, so just unplug or use a power strip to cut it off, and that's another percent or so. In fact, some people have suggested that 5-12% of our electricity is actually used with vampire or phantom energy, as we call it, that standby energy of turning on your microwave or your computer or whatever that would be. So all of those are easy things to do for your home. And there are still incentives for doing some of those things as well. And the other thing you could do is you could give presents at Christmas time that would take care of a few of those things as well. Instead of, you know, toys, give us Power Strip.
You're listening to Coastline. It's an exploration of emerging energy technologies and the growth of renewables in North Carolina. With us answering your questions on this Wednesday, Roger Hsu, senior lecturer in UNCW's Earth and Ocean Sciences and Environmental Science Department, and Steve Calland, executive director of the North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center at NC State. If you have your own question, you can call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Martin from Oak Island, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Well, I was calling to say that back in, I flipped the switch on it back in May the 13th, 2015. I had solar panels installed and been running ever since. And I actually generate far more electricity than I consume. So as of my last bill, I've got 3,609 kilowatt hours banked. Something that's intriguing, though, is they still are charging me a sales tax on it, even though I'm generating far more than I'm consuming. I get charged $28.36 a month for electric service. I get charged $1.99 sales tax. And they're still charging me on that REPS, you know, renewable energy rider of 36 cents a month. And it's ironic, like I say, because I generate every scrap of electricity and far more than I use.
Steve Calland, I know you're not the utility, but can you kind of explain why this is set up this way? Thanks so much for your call, Martin.
Sure. I can't speak to the sales tax piece. I'm not sure how that is structured, but the REPS charge, the 36 cents, that goes to basically cover the cost of a bill that passed back in 2007, which was the Renewable Energy and Efficiency Portfolio Standard. That law basically asked, you know, the electric utilities in the state to function much like we do when we do our own stock portfolios, to diversify risk by diversifying the types of energy sources that they rely on. And so there was, at that time especially, there was some cost differential in moving into solar and other technologies that were more expensive than traditional energy resources. And the utilities were given the opportunity to recover some of that cost on the bill of everyone because, in theory, the benefit of risk reduction benefits everyone that is a utility customer. The larger portion that he spoke of, which is the kind of the electricity service charge, that's really a fee that you pay in order to have the utility available as a backup. If you want to be connected to the utility, everybody has a piece of the pie that they pay that covers kind of what we call the fixed costs of the system, the wires and poles and the power
plants. Infrastructure.
The infrastructure, that's right. Now, traditionally, a lot of net metering customers, customers that generate their own energy and generate some amount of excess, at least at some time during the day, they push that energy back into the grid and, in essence, would run their meter backwards. It's a little more complicated than that, but the way it originally started was you would push an electromechanical meter backwards and you would, in essence, get a credit as the meter ran backwards.
And that's what Martin's talking about when he says he's banked a certain amount.
Correct. What has become a little bit of a struggle in recent years, not just here in North Carolina, but in some of our neighboring states, most recently South Carolina and Kentucky, is that utilities are pushing back and saying that the customers that are benefiting from this are not paying their fair share of that fixed cost. And so they're trying to escalate that flat part of the bill, the fixed fee for service, because they're not recovering as much on the retail rate of electricity that's basically a per kilowatt charge. Now, there are a lot of studies out there that have looked at this issue in different states and at the feds at the national labs that have said that the benefit of distributed energy on the grid actually outweighs those costs. And there are other studies that say that it's the reverse. And so depending on which answer you're looking for, there's lots of information out there to back up your position. That is a discussion that's about to happen again in North Carolina over the next year or so at the Utilities Commission. We're going to be having a conversation about net metering and whether it should be changed in some way. My hope is that we will find a way to value solar appropriately that incorporates not only the costs to the grid associated with those losses of not recovering costs for infrastructure, but that we can look at some of the benefits of that distributed resource and make sure that that's calculated in the value as well. And I think what we'll find is that fixed costs in the state will actually probably drop for solar users after that conversation happens, if there is a good process that kind of evaluates both the pros and the cons.
Now, will that conversation be part of the process of the Duke Energy Progress just asked the North Carolina Utilities Commission to approve a rate hike? Is that going to be part of that conversation?
It won't be a part of that conversation, but it will be a conversation with the utilities and with other renewable energy advocates that happens in front of the Utilities Commission. There is a docket for net metering where that conversation will likely happen, and I don't think they've started that because, frankly, they've been very tied up with the rate cases. They just wrapped one up here for Duke Energy Progress. They're working on the one for Duke Energy Carolinas, the other end of the state right now.
This is the second rate hike request.
Correct. And then there's also a series of cases that came out of House Bill 589 to implement different pieces of that as well. So there's been a lot going on at the Utilities Commission for the last few months.
And some financial analysts have looked at this second rate hike request and said that the move is in sync with Duke's aim of investing it in generating cleaner energy. Likely to increase value for customers. They're talking about this as a positive thing. However, Duke Energy has lost nearly 8% in the last 12 months. That's compared with the broader industry decline of about 5.5%. And one analyst says this underperformance may have been caused by the potential volatility in market prices of fuel, electricity, and other renewable energy commodities that could create further operational risks for the company. This is always part of the picture, the volatility, especially with emerging energy technologies. How does a large utility get a handle on that?
Well, there's been a lot of uncertainty out there lately, particularly in federal policy that has contributed some of this. Part of it was the large federal tax credit discussion. There was a lot of question as to how that might impact solar and other renewable technologies. It resolved in a way that really didn't have a significant impact on solar. There were some opportunities to level the playing field between solar and other technologies that didn't get taken up, but most of the existing tax incentives were kept for solar. There was also a discussion at FERC, the federal regulators, talking about whether we were going to start incentivizing baseload power, nuclear power plants and coal plants, in a way to protect them from the insurgency of natural gas is the biggest player, but then renewables is a second piece. That conversation went nowhere and has kind of evaporated now. But there was a third piece, which was a discussion about tariffs. And in fact, there was an article or a discussion on the main NPR earlier today on this topic. And solar tariffs were something that really could have done significant damage to the solar industry. They did wind up with some tariffs, but much smaller than was originally thought. And so my hope is that it will have an impact, but not as significant an impact as might have otherwise happened.
And we're having some good questions coming in. Alan is asking about heat pumps, which we'll get to in a second. We have Charles from Wilmington on the phone. But you mentioned nuclear. Can you kind of give us a feel, Roger Hsu, for where nuclear fits into the idea of emerging energy technologies? We had that, you know, federal government support in the 1990s, and that made it much easier for nuclear reactor developers to pursue technology. That went away, and it's been a struggle since then.
Well, nuclear has, to me, a real role in the energy picture because once they're built, you know, they're clean. We have 99 units in the United States. We produce 30% of the global nuclear. And believe it or not, we actually added some nuclear capability in 2016 from a Tennessee plant. And there are four units that are, you know, being looked at and under construction now. I think one of the things that you look at with nuclear is that the life cycle that you have in nuclear, many of those are going to start expiring soon. Some of them, like the Southport plant, which is about a 2-gigawatt unit, actually, was retrofitted and extended the life of, which several of the plants are looking at right now. But there are plants that are being retired, too. And this is one of the things that's important for us. And not just that, but as Steve mentioned with coal and the others, there hasn't been a coal plant built since 2013, and none are planned, really. In fact, most of them are retiring, and that's why Duke, and looking in North Carolina of changing the natural gas, but also the renewable picture, is really important. Duke has retired, 7 plants in North Carolina, and in 2020, the
coal-powered plants. Yeah.
And Asheville is going to go away in 2020 to go to natural gas as well.
What about some of the newer nuclear technologies that were supposed to be smaller, easier to commercialize, like Silex? I mean, there's a Virginia utility that has a permit or is getting a permit from the Nuclear Regulatory Commission for an ESBWR plant. But what about?
Just a quickie comment, then Steve can make a comment. One of the things that we've had an issue with nuclear over the years is cost. And if we had utilized a standard design and some of the smaller capability, we could have actually done this much cheaper and much more efficient than what we have.
Yeah, I mean, nuclear's facing a tough road right now. They've been, there were several construction plans that were underway that have been canceled recently, particularly in South Carolina, that have really roiled the state's overall politics, much less the energy politics down there. And we don't see a lot of likely new announcements for new construction of nuclear plants in this country. I would say overseas that's not the case. There certainly is opportunity in places. Small modular nuclear reactors may be the next wave that eventually comes to the U.S., but we've got a lot of work to do to figure out the regulatory and safety issues and the business economics.
You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at renewable energy technology in North Carolina, how some technologies are enjoying more commercial success, like solar, and what the impact of the state's energy policy is on these emerging sectors. We have two energy experts with us today. After this break, you'll have one more segment to get your question in. We'll hear from Alan and from Charles. You can call us at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. You're listening to Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. The use of cleaner, renewable energy technologies is growing around the world, as reported by the International Energy Agency. How does North Carolina compare, and what promising new technologies are emerging here? We have Steve Calland, Executive Director of NC State's North Carolina Clean Energy Technology Center, and Roger Hsu of UNCW's Earth and Ocean Sciences and Environmental Science Departments, answering your questions on this Wednesday. You can either call us at 910-343-1138 or email us today at coastline@whqr.org. This is the last segment, so you have just a few minutes left to get your question in. Alan writes, please have your guests speak to the use of heat pumps. I live on the coast and wonder if there is an economically more efficient way to heat my home. Roger Hsu.
I am not an expert on heat pumps. I will say that, just as an example, we looked at geothermal on the campus of UNCW to see if we could supply, heat from geothermal sources into a little cafeteria, restaurant kind of thing. And it wasn't enough, but it certainly provides energy. I don't have familiarity, though, with heat pumps, so I'll beg off on that.
Yeah, Steve Callen.
I'm unfortunately not a geothermal heat or a heat pump expert either. I will say that just recently in federal legislation, they did renew the tax credit for geothermal heat pumps. So not for regular heat pumps, but for geothermal, if you're looking at that technology, that may be an option.
All right. And we have Charles from Wilmington. Welcome to Coastline. You're on the air. Charles, are you there? Hi, are you there, Charles?
All right. We can't hear Charles. He called to tell us about a local EcoStar company working wave action and tunnel generator. What, Steve Callen, you're nodding. What kind of technology is that?
Those are ocean energy technologies, which I would characterize as probably a little bit farther from the market today, but that do hold some potential, particularly in areas that are close to the coast. I think that they have, again, a balancing set of questions around ecosystem impacts and things that might, be problematic about them, but that those are technologies that could produce very clean energy. And so when, put in the context of costs and benefits, looking at the climate issues versus ecosystem issues, it's always challenging in energy. And you have to kind of weigh that. But it's pretty early in the game for OTEC.
A couple of those things. There's much, much energy in moving water. So waves, tides, ocean currents. The problem is harnessing those in a fashion that provides the scale that we need right now. There are certainly areas that have tidal energy sources around the globe since the 1960s. And there's experimental designs and looking at capturing things in the Gulf Stream, for instance. But again, cost factor is really the big issue associated with many of those. Hopefully down the road, we can capture more of that. It certainly could supply, all the needed energy that we need globally.
We hear all the time that the challenge with wind and the challenge with solar is that the sun doesn't always shine and the wind doesn't always blow. And so it gets down to storage technology and what our capacity is for that. Where are we now on that spectrum, Steve Callen?
Well, I'm glad you raised that, because that is really the area in North Carolina and nationally that probably has the most attention today. Storage technologies, particularly battery technologies, but other storage technologies, everything from pump storage, hydro, to fuel cells, to thermal storage, are getting a whole lot of attention, and most of that is because of the dramatic drop in cost of battery technology. So there are actually a number of utility-scale battery demonstration projects going on in North Carolina. In fact, there's a number of them here in Brunswick County that are being done. And right now, utilities are investigating ways to take intermittent resources, which is what we call solar or wind, intermittent because the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow, and move them from that 20% capacity, or in the case of wind, maybe it's a 35% capacity, move that capacity number up, or capacity factor up to 50%, 80%, whatever it might be able to achieve. The big limitation right now is cost, but the cost on solar and the cost on storage are both dropping at very, very fast pace. And so we're starting to see around the country solar paired with storage competing directly with natural gas technologies in certain applications. And if you go to, for example, an island like Puerto Rico that's going to be doing a significant amount of reconstruction of their grid, we will probably see solar and storage paired with microgrids and other types of smart grid technology that are designed to try and deal with intermittency and provide increased resilience for the grid and for the energy users on that grid. North Carolina is in a good position to benefit from that because we have one of the largest clusters of smart grid technology manufacturing in the country, in the Research Triangle area, and there's other companies down in the Charlotte area. And in the Charlotte area, we have this huge cluster of kind of traditional energy companies that were all attracted by Duke Energy and its plans. And so putting those pieces together as a state, we have a lot of opportunity to really grow our presence in the national and international energy situation as we move more into the new technology space.
We have an email from Joe. He writes, to reduce energy systems, it's important to see the cost of solar panels and system costs have dropped in the last few years. More RV campers and vans are incorporating 200-watt solar to two 12-volt batteries to power up LED lighting and powering small 12-volt fridge freezer in camping off-grid. This is happening more often over the last 5 to 10 years. Will continue to impact those using camping trips, moving away from the use of small generators often used for short-term camping adventures. These aspects are not often discussed, but should be, as more and more citizens are getting out to see more of our nation on the road. Roger Hsu, can you kind of give us a picture? I said in the introduction that we're seeing the growth of usage of these alternative energy technologies expanding around the globe. How much, can you tell us about a corresponding drop in the use of fossil fuels for energy sources?
Yes.
Or is energy demand just increasing all over the globe?
Well, there's two points to that. One is energy demand is increasing. And globally, it's really important to look at that many of the countries, China, India, all the developing countries, you know, really want to be like us. And so everyone wants to be middle class. And whenever you look at that, for instance, one of the big things is in meat production and the other one is in air conditioning. Air conditioning globally is going to be one of the big deals for energy consumption. In fact, you're looking at over 1 billion units going to be put in, you know, in the developing countries, India, et cetera. Now, in North Carolina, one of the things that we've seen, and it's true in the U.S., is there has been a dramatic change in energy consumption type and demand. And that big demand change has been coal. And the primary thing that's been mentioned already is natural gas leading to that change. In North Carolina, in 2010, coal was number one. By 2015, nuclear had displaced coal as number one for supplying electricity in North Carolina. And now the number one is running neck and neck, depending upon the season, is natural gas and nuclear. And coal is third. And in fact, as we've mentioned already, Duke has retired several plants. The country has retired multiple plants. And Duke is looking to reduce it all the way down to probably 25% coal by 2022. So that has been the major change. Now, the other part that's come in, if you look at energy capacity installation in the country, if you looked at 2016, the three, plus a little bit of nuclear and biomass, the big three were solar and wind, and natural gas. Those are the big three. They account for well over 90% of installed capacity in this country, and that's what's projected for the next years and years. I would like to add one more thing, too, though. One of the things, as you look at, a lot of people have said is that we can actually go to just renewable energy. This is a stretch, but we could just go to renewable energy by 2050, but that would imply that 50% of that energy would be taken care of in conservation and efficiencies. So it's really important to maintain that piece of the story too. You can't snap your fingers on any of these things to make them happen. It's a concerted effort. It's laws like HB 589 and others that allow people to start thinking about alternatives for development of our energy sources.
So with that in mind, the U.S. Energy Information Administration says that after declining by a little more than 0.5% last year, energy-related carbon dioxide emissions will actually increase by 1% this year and by another 0.8%, almost 1% in 2019. And of course, energy-related CO2 emissions are sensitive to changes in weather, economic growth, energy prices. What does that mean then, with this drop, and now we're starting to bump that up again with the growth of alternative energies?
Well, I think one of the things to look at there is it is 1%, and it's removed from minus 1% to 1%. The real issue globally is that India went up 5%. So the United States in doing this is, you know, pretty much staying on track, increased production, increased population. We've actually had basically a flat CO2, and that's because of looking at renewables and also the move to natural gas. Now, quickly say that if you don't capture the natural gas as it's leaking, then we're basically not going to be benefiting from natural gas. It'd be the same as coal. So we need green capture and technology to capture the methane because it's even more effective in CO2. But 91% of our emissions come from fossil fuels. The other part is cement, agriculture, and things. So we need to make sure and, you know, adhere to as much as we can, you know, the idea of reduced consumption, changing to our energy mix, and I think that will get us there. The problem is it's not the U.S. acting alone. And right now with the Paris Accord, which wanted only 1.5 degrees C rise, actually with what's going on with people that are emitting, they're not meeting what they had said, you're actually looking at doubling, you know, the temperature to not just 2, but maybe even 3 to 4 degrees.
Okay, I want to get to Christy in Southport. She has a question about solar shingles. But first, we've mentioned methane capture a couple of times. There is a farm now operating in Harnett County. Is that right, Steve Callen? Mm-hmm. That it's a hog farm, and they are capturing the methane that rises off the lagoons with the hog waste?
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, North Carolina is kind of an interesting place in that we're blessed with lots and lots of different renewable energy options, and one of them is animal waste, both swine and poultry. We have a lot of folks that have looked at this for years, and it's been a tough nut to crack just because of the economics involved, but we're starting to get close now, I think, to seeing more significant energy capture on these farms. And we're starting to see some actual projects that are economically viable that are starting to move forward. Some of those projects are capturing that methane on the farm, or they're using anaerobic digesters and capturing the gases there. What we may start to see is what we call directed biogas, where rather than trying to use the gas on site to generate energy, we may see that gas getting cleaned up, and there's some new standards for that are going through the Utilities Commission now that would kind of dictate what you'd need to do to kind of that biogas to clean it up so that it matches what's in regular natural gas, and then you could put it into the natural gas pipeline and burn it with natural gas, basically reducing the amount of natural gas that gets used by displacing it with the biogas. The general idea is very similar to what we do in electricity, where you might put solar electricity in the grid in Brunswick County, and that those electrons go wherever the grid goes, and so they will go. From an engineering standpoint, they'll go to the closest load. But in general, the grid is almost like a big bucket, and you're dumping energy, whether it is solar electrons or coal electrons, into the bucket, and then you're taking a ladle and pulling out electrons somewhere else. So the idea is to kind of use the same analogy in the biogas conversation and be able to put these cleaned up animal gases into the gas pipeline and have somebody else use them somewhere else. And a lot of that gets dealt with contractually.
Christy from Southport, welcome to Coastline. You're on the air.
Thank you. What I want to know is, when is Tesla going to arrive with their solar shingles in the area? I have a roof that needs to be replaced, and I would like to replace half of it, at least, with the Tesla solar shingle. Have either of your guests heard when they're slated to be here?
Steve Callen, any ideas? Roger Shue's shaking his head. Yeah. Thanks for your question, Christy.
Yeah, I don't have a specific timeline for you, unfortunately, but I can tell you that there are a lot of companies like Tesla and others that are now giving North Carolina another look for kind of the residential rooftop market and the commercial rooftop market. Another aspect of that House Bill 589 bill that passed last summer was something called a third-party leasing program. And that is a program that's designed to allow a third party to come in and offer maybe a more economic deal to allow rooftop owners to get access to solar. One of the big problems with residential and commercial solar is that the scale is much smaller than these large utility solar farms, and the scale has been absolutely critical in driving down the cost of those large solar farms, along with some of these other incentives that were in place. Third-party leasing combined with the new utility rebate program we mentioned and the federal tax credit that we mentioned, North Carolina starts to get to be a more interesting market for rooftop solar, and hopefully Tesla and others will come and join us.
And we'll put some resources on our website with some of that information. Thank you both so much, Steve Calland, Roger Shue. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you much.
Glad to do it.
That's this edition of Coastline. Coastline's technical director is Ken Campbell. Producer is Rachel Keith. Caitlin Hanrahan was today's chief engineer. Caroline DeVries is our webmaster. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org, get the podcast, or find it on the WHQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast of this episode Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.